a five-hour documentary, Kind-Hearted Woman. It's a David Sutherland film. Many of you are familiar with his work, I'm sure. It's about Robin Charbonneau, an Oglala Sioux and member of North Dakota's Spirit Lake tribe. And David follows her for more than 3 years as she struggles with so many different issues, her own alcoholism, struggling with raising her children as a single mother, struggling with her memories, her mom being an alcoholic. She was taken from her mother at the age of 5 and lived at a neighbor's house. Her mother froze to death when she was 30 years old. Her brother is struggling with issues of alcohol and drugs, and it's quite a story, and it's done in this style. Those of you who are familiar with David Sutherland's work know that he describes his work as cinematic portraiture. He did a couple films with PBS, Country Boys, which took 7 years to bring to fruition, and he returned to the hills of Appalachian Kentucky to document the coming of age faced by two teenage subjects. He also did this film, The Farmer's Wife, which is sound designed so that the viewer hears the subjects breathing, sighing, and groaning from 100 yards away. David says his objective is to make you feel that you are living in their skin, and that's exactly what happens after you've watched the documentary that will air tonight. You are living in these people's skins. There's no doubt about that. David is one of our guests this hour as we talk about the documentary. David, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I feel like I watched most of the documentary. I watched it on Saturday, but a lot of it on Easter Sunday, so I'm still there. I'm here today, but my mind and my heart is with your incredible documentary. Also joining us is Isaiah Broken Leg, and he is a member of the Rosebud Sioux tribe, grew up in South Dakota, and he has a BA from the University of Minnesota, with majors in multicultural studies as well as applied social justice, human rights, master's of public health degree from University of Minnesota. He works as a program director epidemiologist for the Great Lakes Tribal Council's Community Transformation Grant. And we thank you so much, Isaiah, for joining us this hour as well. Hello.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. We'll be welcoming phone calls for both our guests. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. I have read, and I'm wondering if this is true, David, that you set out initially to do a film about abuse, and you found Robin, and as a result of that, the film is about all kinds of abuse, but it goes beyond that, doesn't it? You had a huge story to tell, or she does.
Well, actually, the thing that most people don't realize, and this is maybe one of the few forums for it, is that I had missed abuse in Country Boys and The Farmer's Wife. It was in the backdrop.
Mm.
And I actually, after Country Boys, my life got a little hard, and it took 7 years, and I didn't think I would do another film. And when I decided to, I wanted to capture abuse, again, rural poverty, which I'm interested in. And because I work with rural mental health groups and had done some public service work after both The Farmer's Wife and Country Boys, on tour, I had been in North Dakota and wanted to go back there. And through some of these rural mental health groups and time in North Dakota, I got hooked up with some rural mental health groups there, and was led to a group called Life After Fear, where by a woman who named Bonnie Palachek, who ran the North Dakota Council on Abused Women Services and had compiled a lot of the statistics about women in North Dakota for the last 40 years and written some of the legislation for women. Some of them were Native. When I went to this group, I'll be very brief on recovering women. It was to try out my idea. I got the profiles of about 25 of these members who were going to discuss their issues. I was told most of them were very well along in their recovery. Two of the women were Native, and I decided, but they switched the names, so I didn't know who was who. And I decided immediately that the one thing I wasn't interested in was doing Native women, as to finding a subject on a Native woman, because I figured middle-aged white men historically had caused Natives enough trouble in this country. So for whatever happened during the break, there was one woman whose story was very interesting to me in particular, who wasn't that far along in her recovery from abuse. And I asked her, "Do you hate men?" And she laughed and said, "No." And that led me to go to the Newtown Reservation. She was Native. And what changed my mind was I'm a portraitist, and in The Farmer's Wife, I tried to put a face on family farmers in the 90s. And in Country Boys, two kids growing up the last 3 years of high school in eastern Kentucky. Not saying that any of them represented everyone, but I'm a portraitist. And then I started to think, well, I never do stories about just the issue of rural poverty, and in this case, rural poverty and abuse, and in another far-off corner of rural America. And what I started to think about, well, unless you are Native or live near Natives, and Natives I know live all over the country. I lived in Colorado. But do most people in mainstream America know a Native that you, Natives that you root for up close? Because the subjects of my films are usually people that have a quest. Not the issues come out of the people. As I said, I'm a portraitist. And you go through the experience the way I mic them, where you feel like you're living in their skin. And they have a quest, and I think they can go the distance, and they're articulate. And so my goal became, one of the issues is she's recovering from abuse. But I just started to think about, well, I'm from Massachusetts. Maybe I know Pocahontas was somewhere here, although Massachusetts didn't really exist then. So my goal became would be, if at the end of the film you're rooting for a family with all their issues and trials and tribulations, who just happened to be Native. I never thought that Robin's daughter, I thought she was going off to college to continue her quest to help her people, but and go back to the tribe and help them, which was her quest was. I never thought that anything would happen to Darian. And I also thought she was too passive and that she couldn't effectuate change. Little did I know. I know I'm wrong more than half the time, but I never thought they would move five times. So here I did. I'm not saying I put a face on all Native Americans. Please don't think that. But I am saying that if on Thanksgiving or some other time, because her son says, well, the Indians invented Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. He says that when they're moving. And if you worry about them come Thanksgiving or any other time in 2 weeks or a month after you've seen the film, then you happen to know a family who happened to be, that you've rooted for, who happened to be Native American. Mm-hmm. And that's all I was trying to do. In this case, I never thought this. My film was done when this news broke about Spirit Lake. I had no interest in that. I'm not an investigative reporter, although in this case, it almost is like I became one. But then the story broke, and I guess the New York Times said it was like Exhibit A on what's been going on there. But that was never my intention. Mm-hmm. But I have to own it, and that's it.
And the story was what, David, the story that broke?
Well, it was about the federal government stepping in and overseeing some of the social services there, amongst other things. Because it's different on every reservation or in different states. Like in Minnesota, the state controls some of the social services. Because, I think your other guest could explain it probably. He's probably more qualified than I am.
Isaiah?
Well, each reservation or tribe is unique, and they have a unique relationship with the state and the federal government. And so in some cases, the federal government can control it, and in others, the tribe will do it themselves, and others they might have a mutual aid agreement or some other sort of agreement where the state would do it for them,
mm-hmm.
or with them.
It's hard. We do care about, and you really accomplished your mission of caring and rooting for this family to make it, but the historical context is omnipresent. The cold, the reservation, the isolation, the having to walk so far to get anywhere, the incredible poverty, dealing with federal court system, tribal councils, etc. Can you, Isaiah, give us a little bit of a perspective as we watch this tonight? How did Spirit Lake Tribe wind up in this, in some ways beautiful, in many ways godforsaken area where it's freezing cold and you are really isolated?
Well, I think historically, as the government sort of colonized North America, they had different policies, and the first one was kind of like, you can be anywhere but where we are. And that was sort of the first step. And then the second one was, now you can only be where we tell you you can be. And of course, they're going to put you in the places that they don't want, which tend to be very rural, isolated areas. And oftentimes they don't have the same infrastructure that people from other areas have. So you don't always have things like running water, telephones, common infrastructure things that we take for granted, paved roads, for example. And I think it's part of a long history of, I don't know what you want to call it, institutional oppression ignorance and, I guess, just leaving people behind.
Mm-hmm. David, did you feel like you were kind of at the end of the earth when you were filming in North Dakota?
No, I really didn't. The only time is when the film ends up going to Canada, to the Seine River Reservation, mm-hmm. where Robin's husband-to-be, so to speak, where he's from. There, you could buy groceries, people selling without a sign, out of their houses.
Mm.
And that was a reservation, I think, of about 600 people. That was much more isolated in that context than I had seen. Right across the, about an hour and a half from Fort Frances, on the other side of International Falls, when Robin moves up there. And also, we got involved of the politics of school in one tribe. Would Robin's tribe pay for the kids to go to school because they were members in the Seine River Colony, wanting to charge $25,000 for them to go to school there because the tribe, all of that stuff was, it was so isolated there.
Mm-hmm.
Bears running around, really rurally all over.
Mm-hmm. We should spend a little bit of time, David, for people who have not seen this, and they won't until tonight, talking about the portraits, the three major portraits, Robin and her children, Anthony and Darian. Tell me just a little bit about their lives and how you trace them for how long a period of time.
Well, I traced them for over 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they're taken away from Robin a couple of times. Once she gives them up, and then there's a custody suit. And the thing that's on the Spirit Lake Reservation that was really, really hard for me, not ever imagining any of this would happen when she's moving to Fargo and Moorhead to go to get her BA, and she thinks the kids are coming with her. And then Darian, just before they leave, ends up cutting herself, and Robin thinks that it's because Darian doesn't approve of who she's been going out with. And in any case, she ends up being talked into giving custody of her kids because Darian was depressed. Little does she know that Darian was cutting herself with her father's picture. what she finds out later, and she feels very guilty she didn't listen. So she ends up going there alone, having given up custody of both kids while she's recovering, and she's living in a battered women's shelter in Fargo, Moorhead. And then she gets into school, and you know she's badly battered because when she's living at the YWCA, a battered women's shelter there in Fargo, they ask her, what do you want to do? And she said, well, I could do welding. And then when she reads her resume, you realize she's much more equipped than I am to do anything. She's an incredibly, had great responsibilities with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and her job there.
Yes.
Amongst, in any case, in procurement, writing grants, all types of things for the tribe. In any case, meanwhile, Darian and Anthony have been living with their father, and for the most part, they appear to be very happy there. And what happens is when the kids come to visit, as Robin's starting school on Mother's Day, after Mother's Day, when they come in the summer to visit, right a few weeks before we arrived, we learned that Darian in this scene, but it's already happened, has been abused by her father, and the FBI is checking them out, has checked her out, and either trying to build a case. So the kids are given to Robin with physical custody.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens is the kids are then taken from Robin. She wasn't paying some of the electric bills and some of that one day because she's using all her retirement money and all her time when the kids start school, and they're doing actually quite well, you know, with psychologists, psychiatrists, because Darian is recovering, you know, from all of that, going to school, and Anthony is also very upset about the father, and there's no case, and they're with Robin, at least for now, temporarily. And then what happens is there's no news. Robin's seeing her. Well, I'm not great at being succinct at this, so I could go on forever.
It's a very long documentary. I know.
So, and she loses. It gets so complicated.
I know.
But the big thing to know is she's accused of molesting the kids. And she goes to, by the tribe. So they take the kids and from her. Based on no evidence, while the FBI is getting their case together against the husband. And what happens is they don't even show up in tribal court once. Actually, I believe it was twice in the depositions. I only capture once. And then the judge, who on that reservation and the Spirit Lake Reservation only has to be the rule to be a judge. I'm not saying all judges aren't law trained. But you only have to be 25 years old, and you don't have to be law trained on that reservation to be a judge. And in this case, so finally, when the tribe does show up in court, Rob, they don't even attempt to offer any evidence that she molested her kids, in addition to not showing up in court a few times. So months have gone by. It's been 5 months. And we learned that Robin's ex-husband, the caseworker, Robin's caseworker, has taken the kids, and not in front of Robin, but in front of and admits to it, to a caseworker, another caseworker, the battered women's, in the battered women's group, that she had taken the husband to see the kids. Meanwhile, Robin hasn't seen the kids in 5 months, and there were no charges against her. Finally, she gets her kids back, and then there's a federal trial. And the prosecutor, it's not said in the film, is a Native American who's the U.S. attorney, who I have to say is quite brilliant, because when he knew that they were going to accuse Robin of being an alcoholic. She had been working. She hadn't had a drink, but they knew that that would be the defense. Robin's foster daughter had also come forward, and that's also quite complicated, who the ex-husband had battered at the same age. But the prosecutor basically describes what happened in the court, because I can't film in there.
Mm-hmm.
And what you learn is that Darian has testified that this had been going on before with the ex-husband and Darian, before I ever started filming.
Mm-hmm.
And back in 2006 is where it began. But what you also learn is that Darian had testifies in court, you learn this from the U.S. attorney, that she wants to live with her father, and she looks at him and he can't look at her if he would only stop touching her. So she had chosen living with her father if he would stop touching her, and that's what she says in court. So how could Robin have made up all this stuff about her ex-husband if Darian wants him to stop touching her and still wants to live with her? It can't be custody. And this attorney is quite brilliant. So he takes the custody issue away from everything. And Spirit Lake. At the time of the trial when this goes on, and this is only the first 3 hours of the film, there's also the healing and the recovery. And you watch Robin become a speaker and a great mom and learn how to love. As she says when she starts speaking, no one ever taught me how to love. No one ever taught me how to be a mother.
Right. She had no idea. She had no models. We need to pause for a moment. We'll return and welcome phone calls. I want to speak with Isaiah about issues that so many generations are dealing with. It was interesting that alcoholism was something her mother dealt with, and the film starts where she is just out of a recovery program and she's having her house purified. We'll talk about that ritual and the issue of abuse, sexual abuse, how prevalent it may be, how it is dealt with, particularly on reservations. We'll ask Isaiah about that, but we'll welcome your phone calls as well. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Kind-Hearted Woman, a David Sutherland film, will premiere tonight on PBS Frontline, and David is with us. And also with us is Isaiah Broken Leg. He is a member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe, and he works as a program director epidemiologist for the Great Lakes Tribal Council's Community Transformation Grant. More phone calls. Well, we'll take phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Isaiah, before we go to phone calls, I'd like for you to address what appear to be some generational issues, issues with alcoholism, issues with sexual abuse that are so prevalent and so disturbing in Kind-Hearted Woman. And if you could tell us how various reservations have dealt with these really substantial issues, if there is progress being made, if there is some way that we all need to pay more attention to these stories so that Robin doesn't have to struggle so hard?
Well, I think that Robin's experience is not unique. American Indians experience abuse and sexual assault at rates higher than any other ethnic group. And I think there's a stereotype in the Indian community and outside the Indian community that Indians are alcoholics. And I think when people see the poverty and a lot of the other things, they sort of tend to judge American Indians without actually looking at the whole picture. And what I like to talk about, or what you're seeing in a lot of communities, is what's referred to as historical or generational trauma. And normally, one generation passes on their culture, parenting skills, customs, language, love, all of that stuff on to the next generation. And I like to think of that stuff that's passed on as sort of cultural DNA. And in situations of historical or generational trauma, something prevents or corrupts this transfer of the cultural DNA. And in the case of American Indians, it was government policies and boarding schools that prevented or stopped this transfer. So instead, the DNA that got transferred included things like loss of language, religion, land, and culture, along with abuse, adoption, death, and genocide. So even though the trauma affected that one generation, or maybe two generations, it's still affecting the current generations now, because what gets passed on includes things like suicide and violence, abuse, addiction, hopelessness, depression, all of these things. So if you consider the immense energy, time, and money that it took to commit the trauma in the first place, you would need something just as immense to change it. So it could be something really big, or lots and lots of smaller things and tribes, which often need support and funding and so forth. They don't have a lot of funding to put toward these things, so they're trying to do a lot of smaller things, and it's going to take a long time before you can heal those wounds and repair them. But a lot of tribes are working on it. I definitely think communities and tribes are aware of the issues, many of the issues that are going on, and they're doing the best that they can with what they have to work on those things.
And Robin, David, is so concerned about this. She's working for a variety of agencies and doing great work. She does have a breakdown, psychological breakdown at one point, which is understandable, and somebody sees that as a weakness in her. But she can, with all of the passion that she has about this, it's hard for her to make a living helping other women who have struggled as she is struggling. It's hard for her. And I have two questions. Is there not enough money in place to allow people like Robin to help? And how it is that Robin wanted to go back to the reservation after all that had happened to her to help other people?
She had a dream, and this is really true. When I first met her, okay, I was wrong. You can't help have a take on people. So I found other subjects, but she wrote poetry, and I'm nice, so I told you I was afraid of her the first time I met her. Maybe I didn't. It was in another interview. Because I was the third person she told, and she was so emotional when I was introduced to her. And she wanted to drive my rent-a-car. And she didn't stop crying and started telling me about what happened to her. And essentially, the first thing she told me was that she wanted to go back. She wanted to leave when she decided to go to college and had this quest. The first thing she said is she wanted to leave and come back and help her people. And that's what she really, really wanted to do. And, you know, when you talk about being traumatized, and what Isaiah said makes a lot of sense to me. It really does. Because I met a lot of women that were recovering that were Native from these battered women's groups on the reservation. And all of them, many of them I'm still in touch with by email. They're incredibly welcoming. Many of them did drink, but not all of them. But the trauma of being battered, I mean, Robin still shakes sometimes. And in terms of, well, first of all, there are too many questions out there, and I'm not great at being succinct, so let me stay on target.
Okay.
The reason that she'll probably always have to be two steps forward and one or a half step back. You can't have, with her foster family, the amount of rape and abuse from the time she was young. Mm-hmm. I can't say it's unusual, but for people that I met, ladies that I met, her personal story was extreme. I mean, it doesn't matter. Someone can say whether it's been 10 times you've been raped or abused, but the amount that she went through over years is incredible. And I don't mention that in the film because how are you going to watch a film? It gets too depressing. Mm-hmm. With Darian, that's another story. And, I mean, she does. You'll watch the film and hear her story.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of, so she's probably always going to get depressed off and on. How could you not? I mean, she's a human being, right? You've got those memories. But at the same time, one of the reasons I chose her is she has a great sense of humor. You know, I could say to her, like, after she gave her first speech, and she always amazes me. I'd tell her she did great. I said, but don't get a fat head. And she'll look at me, and then she'll say, I might get a double chin. You know, but that's how her personality is throughout the whole film with her kids. She can pull herself together. She's pretty amazing that way, but she's going to have her scars. And I can't tell you, I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist. But talking about some of those programs, a lot of rural mental health programs have lost funding over the years. And I work with some of these groups. I've done stuff for them. I don't work as a fee. I've just, if I do a film and they want to use the film or they need me to go and talk about making it, I'm very much of a small entity, and I do it if I'm asked to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And they've helped me find subjects. But funding for the type of programs that Robin was doing in Minnesota, and some of them, you know, when there are government cutbacks or the economy's bad, they're the first ones to lose funding.
Right.
And I also think with Native American programs, they probably lose funding very quickly. Isaiah probably knows much more about that type of stuff. I mean, she's done a lot of speaking in front of U.S. attorneys about that type of recovery. But the stuff like talking about the good touch, bad touch,
mm-hmm.
she can talk to all types of groups. She's also done work on reservations. In Minnesota, she had a drive all over. In North Dakota, she gets a good job for a year talking to the tribes in North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
But also when her ex-husband got out, and it was also hard staying there. Then back in North Dakota, she's not the most popular person on that reservation.
I'm sure she's not. And after tonight and tomorrow, she'll be perhaps even less popular or more. I don't know. Isaiah, could you respond to that before we go to some phone calls? People want to talk about this lack of parity in health issues. What you've seen?
Well, Indian Health Service, which is sort of the trust responsibility that the U.S. government has for American Indians, and it's written into several different treaties with almost every tribe that they will take care of the health of American Indians, is tragically and grossly underfunded. They spend more money on federal prisoners per person than they do on American Indian health. So federal prisoners get better health care, in theory, because they're spending more money on it per person than American Indians, which I think is federal prisoners need health care too, but I think it's wrong to not provide health care that you have agreed to people. So for every dollar that Indian Health Service needs nationally, they receive about 60 to 70 cents.
Hmm.
And in this area, Bemidji area, which is Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, it's funded even less than that, like 30 or 40 cents. And it varies from year to year, but it's always been underfunded and grossly so. One thing that's very positive, though, is the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act,
yes.
which allows for more funding in areas of sexual assault and domestic violence. But it also allows tribes now to prosecute non-Indians on reservations, which they weren't allowed to do before. And so you have lots of people who could go onto reservation, non-Indians, commit sexual assault, or whatever violence, and they're not allowed to be prosecuted by the tribe, which is just wrong. And people were getting away with all sorts of really bad things.
Let's go to some phone calls. Ron is our first caller. Hello, Ron. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Ron.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for taking my call, and hello to David and Isaiah. I hope people watch the program tonight. I think it's really important. And I'm sure it's not going to be easy to watch it sometimes, but I think people need to see it. So I hope they do. One of the things I wanted to comment on, and maybe this is more for Isaiah than David, but one thing that, first of all, I'm going to give you a little background. I used to work on the Indian reservations in North Dakota. I'm retired now, but I was a federal employee for a soil conservation agency there in North Dakota. And I worked on the Spirit Lake Reservation and also Fort Berthold and up at Turtle Mountain as well, and work with some of the tribal workers there on natural resource and conservation issues. And one of the things that I found time and again is working with these folks, there were a lot of good people that wanted to make a difference, and that's the folks that I mainly worked with, and it was really good to work with these people and see their enthusiasm and see their work. But what I found, especially with federal agencies, is they go in and they start a program or they set up a program, and they walk away and there's no follow-up. And so there's a knowledge that's passed on, and all at once it just gets it gets dropped, and things happen, and it doesn't it just doesn't seem to move forward. And the federal employee probably ends up getting an award. You know, I work with the tribe and so on, but it really isn't. It's not substantial work carrying forward. And I would hope that people who work with the tribes, and to understand that the tribes too are they're a separate nation, you know, and you look at these problems that have been pointed out, and mm-hmm. Reservations are young, they're young nations, and they're going to make mistakes, just like our nation making mistakes. So, you know, that's part of the deal too. But I guess I'd like the comment, probably from Isaiah, is how can we as a society, you know, work with the reservations and just ensure that we're helping them rather than starting and walking
away. Isaiah.
Well, I think just on the initial thing that I think is really helpful is to, as human beings, we all work with relationships. And when you come into a community, I think a lot of like federal people, they enter the community as an employee of the federal government, and they don't think of the people that they're working with as, you know, Sarah or Jody or whomever. They see them as an Indian person. And the same thing, you know, when you come as a federal employee onto the reservation, we see you as, you know, this federal employee or this teacher or anthropologist or clergy person. And it takes time to develop relationships so we can see someone as a human being and with all their personality traits. And so I think, number one, build relationships with folks in your communities and on the reservation. And as far as from a federal perspective, I think we need a lot more conversations about sustainability and how we can develop programs and make them sustainable. And I think that's one of the unfortunate problems with the way federal funding occurs and how it happens is that you can have programs sometimes that are very, very successful that then just get like cut off at the knees and they don't get to become sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to do a lot more work in tribal consultation with the different federal agencies. There's several that are mandated to have tribal consultation, and their version of that is deciding what they're going to do, inviting a couple tribes, and then telling them what they think they're going to do, and not really, it's not a collaborative event. It's more like, here's what we want to do. And I know that happens sometimes with the state of Wisconsin as well. There's not as much collaboration as I think there needs to be in order to make effective decisions and do effective work.
Mm-hmm. David, switching focus here for just a moment, this film is going to air nationwide tonight and continue tomorrow. It is such a personal, intimate look at Robin's life and her children's lives, and I'm wondering what will happen as a result of her story being seen nationwide. Does she worry about that? Do you worry about that for her? You said she's not welcome particularly by her neighbors. What is this film
doing? Oh, no, she is in Minnesota. When she moved to International Falls, she was very welcomed. She makes a life for herself there.
Uh-huh.
The town, the whole area, they're very welcoming, whether the police, the fire. She organizes a march there. Her daughter
The march was great, yeah.
She organizes, her daughter, Darian, organizes an international basketball tournament for other victims of abuse, and no, it's not that I'm saying everybody. It's when you in the tribe that she was on, it's much more the players that she had to deal with. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Who don't like her? You know, people like her ex-husband's family is a large number. Robin's blood family is very small.
Right.
So basically, and some of her foster family is there,
mm-hmm.
and they're a fairly large family, and they're related to her ex-husband's family. So there are a lot of them. And then some of them work in the field that caused Robin some troubles, like in the social system or friends of them. And so she's more than an odd man out. I'm not saying that she's very likable. So I'm not saying there aren't people there that don't like that. There are people there that like her. I'm just saying it's a harder place for her and her kids to be.
Mm-hmm. So what will it be like for her to have her story be seen for a long period of time tonight and tomorrow on television?
Well, I'll tell you something that you might be surprised about. When we've been on a number of radio shows, and then there are some people that call us, and I think, for my opinion, I think that I'm not Native, but I think that a lot of Native people, I hopefully, will like this family. Why shouldn't they? They're very lovable.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't just my opinion. I really believe that. But I do think that people that are involved in some of that tribe's politics, I don't mean every tribe's, aren't going to like it. But she's already been dealing with them off and on for years, even when she came back and worked there. She's much more, remember one thing, I'm not an investigative reporter. I'm a portraitist. I define myself that way. For me, having something where a topic caught up with my film, it would have gone on national television. It was slated to anyhow. My other two films do. They're very long-form documentary. But this is the first time that I've been caught up in something that seems like an exhibit in, you know, some condemnation of the Spirit Lake tribe, how it's run, or their social services. That wasn't my intention. So
no.
In that sense, if I've been on a show and someone calls up that doesn't like it, and they usually identify themselves politically as being, you know, in some capacity with some group connected either with that tribe or somebody that doesn't like, you know, the up-closeness with the children. Robin is much better equipped to deal with that stuff. I mean, we thought long and hard about that because the kids are older and could have stopped the film going on TV.
Mm-hmm.
But Darian wants to be an advocate, and Anthony likes it. But remember, when I started this film out, it's now almost it's 5 years later, mm-hmm. more than 5 years later, 5.5 years later. So I didn't have to make those decisions early on. So I'm just getting used to talking about something like, oh, my film, maybe it will get other women to speak out. Not just Native women, but women.
Mm-hmm.
But usually they get a portrait like the farmer's wife and they think about, well, what is a family that farms? I can see what they're going through. And maybe they think about the topic. In this case, it's more specific, and I'm not used to that.
Mm-hmm.
She'll come out and say, well, I've taught my kids, I was taught not to speak out on my tribe. And she comes across much more confidently than me and says, and my kids speak out, both of them. And I've taught them to do that, and I want people to speak out. So if I help one woman that went through what I did or Darian did and we did, then maybe it will get someone else to come up with their story. So I'm getting used to saying that,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not as, it's not, I don't have any history in my filmmaking where something became topical.
Mm-hmm.
Where on the other hand, she's very confident. I watch her, she's becoming before my eyes, like I've seen it, like almost like she's becoming a great lady.
Hmm.
And you know, I'm a filmmaker, but I don't do films that start out with an agenda. There are other people that do. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, I know what you're saying.
And so it's a hard, so, and I'm not trying to say, oh, poor me. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people are going to hate me or whatever. But that's all I was going for. I knew the issue of abuse, but I didn't even start out thinking about doing a film on a Native American.
Right, yeah. Look what happened.
So it's different.
Right.
So take that in perspective, I hope people, when they watch it.
Thank you, Ron, very much for your call. Eugene in Viola, hi.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Eugene.
I was Rosebud Reservation for 5 years, from 1975 to 1980. I was teaching junior high math out there at the time. And I think some mistakes that were made was for trying to put the white man's, particularly with the education, was trying to put the white man's code on the Indian, on a Native American. They are individualistic. They are cooperative. They would not compete with each other in the classroom. And what we had to do, there were a group of us that stayed around for a few years. We saw some signs of hope at that point in time and space. And we were giving on everything we had, even with all the alcoholism. Now, if I'm incorrect on my numbers, correct me, but I'm looking, you're looking at, what, 75% alcoholism, 75% unemployment, 2 to 3 murders a month, plus the suicides, pretty much. But even with all the mayhem going on around us, at some points we were succeeding.
Isaiah.
Well, alcohol is a problem in American Indian community, along with suicide and violence. And I know unemployment rates are astronomically high on reservations. 70, I think on mine it was somewhere between 65 and 85% unemployment. And in Wisconsin it varies between anywhere from like 25 to in some cases 85% unemployment. And I think in any community when you have such extreme poverty, unemployment, those kind of issues, you will have alcoholism, you will have domestic violence. And so I don't really know if it's a, like, which came first, the chicken or the egg type of thing, but I do see things happening that are amazing. There's wonderful things happening on Menominee Reservation with the schools there and with the work that they've been doing in their health clinic. And I see all around the work that, the great things that are going on in communities.
Thanks, Eugene, for your call. Dave in Cobb. Hi, Dave.
Hi, yes. Good morning. Over the weekend, Ira Glass had a program on California Indian tribe or connected with a gambling casino that they're trying to enroll in as a member of the tribe, trying to cut back their population or whatever they call that.
Members of the tribe want to cut back their casino operation?
No, the tribe wanted, I think it's got something to do with the casino. They wanted, royalties or whatever, you know, whatever the casino made that they get part of.
I'm not very familiar with this. Is this ringing a bell with you, David, or not?
I don't know anything, no.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I think he might be talking about the share of the casino profits that are going to the state.
Okay.
So they want to lessen the amount of the share of the profits that go to the state. Is that what you're talking about, sir?
Yeah, let's make that what he's talking about because we're running short on time. Do you have a comment on that, Isaiah?
Just it's the federal Congress ruled that in order to have casinos, they have to have the state agree to allow them to have it, which totally takes away tribal sovereignty. And that hasn't been tested in court yet, because I think tribes have a right to have casinos regardless. But anyway, a lot of states force the tribes to pay really high portions of their profits, higher, sometimes double, triple what the tax rate of the state is.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of hold a hostage that way. And then there's all sorts of other issues with the gaming compacts that occur. And so I think that will be an ongoing issue as time goes on mm-hmm. with how those are handled.
Yeah, Isaiah, we're going to have you for a future show. In about 40 seconds, David, where are Robin and Darian and Anthony now?
Today they're in North Dakota. Robin's going to be on a show. And tomorrow they should be in Minnesota. back in International Falls.
They are living in International Falls now.
Yeah, that's where they are. They're back.
And the kids are probably a bit older now, huh?
Yeah, Darian's 17, driving.
Oh.
She's going to apply to college next year. She either wants to go to vet school. She loves to sing. And she definitely said, she said in Pasadena that the press tour that she wants to be an advocate for other kids, for other people her age. Mm. That's what she'd like to do.
Mm. Well, she's well on her way to doing that. Thank you both so much for being with us, our guests this hour. The film will begin tonight, and it airs probably, well, check your local listings. I don't want to say because it's different everywhere. Kind-Hearted Woman, a David Sutherland film. It's a five-hour documentary, and you will be totally engrossed. And it's a whole different pattern. It's a whole different way of talking and walking and scenery and everything. But it's quite a story. We thank David Sutherland and Isaiah Brokenleg for being with us. Thanks to Amanda Magnus and Rhonda Fanning for producing this program.